some very unhappy. And so it's important to recognize that there is a minority of pro-Ukrainians here in Donbass, in particular in the Zaporizhia regions and the Kherson region. There are a large amount of Ukrainians who either won't vote today out of protest or who will vote no. And they particularly will be very unhappy that this referendum is taking place at all.
The fact that the world community doesn't recognize this referendum doesn't have big significance for us, because we, being people of Donbass, want to express our will. Our future depends on our actions and our interests. Let the world community hear our voices, and they'll have to recognize the results of this referendum, because our community, the people of Donbass, wish it to be this way.
While pro-Russians celebrate, for most Ukrainians and NATO, these events remain illegal and illegitimate. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The crisis hit Lebanon is once again a scene of angry masses. The parliament is back to meet and debate a new budget. Yet protesters see the budget being discussed as elusive.
Instead of putting together a budget which encourages development in agriculture, industrial production and all fields in Lebanon, they want to impoverish the people and push them to die in the sea as they immigrate illegally. The government, which relies on debt, is being controlled by a mob, which is the Banks Association and the Central Bank. They should be held accountable for getting billions of dollars out of the country.
Banks reopened partially on Monday following a week-long closure in the wake of a wave of holdups. Depositors stormed at least 7 bank branches in the capital and abroad, demanding their trapped savings.
We know these banks, you know, where we invested our money. But unfortunately, they stole the money between themselves, and they plan, and every time they create a story.
One woman named Saleh Hafiz forced one branch to give her $13,000 of her savings, saying she needed it to pay for her sister's medical treatment. But she didn't take back her money on her own.
They left us no other choice. We encouraged Saleh, and we were with her when she held up the bank, because it was a humanitarian situation, and we will be with all the people who urgently need their money. Our government is rotten and corrupt, and so is the judicial system.
A former member of parliament tells Press TV that the government has been procrastinating while time is running out. The governmental institutions, including schools, are almost out of service.
The entire governmental sector is paralyzed. The workers, the military personnel, the ministerial workers, the public teachers, they all have rights and they can barely do their job. There's no health care, no educational assistance. The budget plan the parliament is debating today is unfair.
Lebanon's economic downfall began in October 2019. The Lebanese pound has lost around 90% of its value against the U.S. dollar, but officials have failed to put in place necessary reforms. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
From September 23rd to 27th, referendums on joining Russia were held in the Donetsk and Lugansk People's Republics, as well as the Zaporozhye and Kherson regions. Pro-Russian representatives of those regions say joining Russia will secure their territories and restore historical justice. They believe the move is vital in the face of what they call constant acts of terror by the nationalist authorities in Kyiv and NATO countries that supply weapons to Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has backed the referendums, saying Moscow will support the decision made by the residents of the four regions.
Today, in the context of a special military operation and referendums in Donbas, saving people in all territories, namely saving people in all territories where this referendum is being held, is the main focus of Russia.
The referendum will determine the fate of 8 million people living in the LPR, the DPR, and the regions of Zaporozhye and Kherson.
People are tired and exhausted. They are being shelled and bombed every day. As a result, the residents of these republics ask authorities to hold referendums as soon as possible. Most of them have been supporting joining Russia since 2014. The second reason is the fear of any potential revenge by the Ukrainian regime.
Decisions of this kind and steps are always taken when the situation allows it. All the pros and cons are weighed. It has now become clear that the referendums are in line with the plans that the top leadership of Russia has. The future of Russia's constituent regions is complicated. Western countries will impose sanctions against their residents, like in the case of Crimea. Those regions were degraded under the Ukrainian leadership. Money was not invested in them at all. And now Russia is trying to ensure security and normal life in those territories.
Despite shelling of the territories where the secession referendums were held, the voter turnout was over 80% in all those regions. First partial results show that the overwhelming majority of the residents are in favor of joining Russia.
Most of the voters believe that if a state can join NATO despite Russia's opposition, then disputed Ukrainian regions can join Russia without the West's approval. Марина Картунова, Moscow.
As largely predicted by pollsters, the Brothers of Italy party has won the most votes in Italy's snap election, leading a right-wing coalition to victory. The turnout for the general election was about 64%, the lowest percentage ever recorded, around 9 points lower than the 73% turnout for the 2018 general election. Brothers of Italy, a group founded 10 years ago by its leader, Giorgia Meloni, grabbed more than 26% of the vote, while its allies, the League and the more moderate Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia, received respectively 9 and 8%. Meloni said on Monday that a future centre-right government would not betray the trust of the Italian people.
Questo è il tempo della responsabilità.
This is a time for responsibility. This is a time in which, if you want to be part of history, you must realize that we have responsibility towards millions of people who chose us. We won't betray it, like we never have.
Meloni's flagship policies include defending traditional social values, anti-immigration programs, and the reduction of taxes. Meloni is slated to become the next prime minister, the first woman in Italy who has ever been appointed to that position. The news that a coalition led by Brothers of Italy won a decisive victory in Italy's snap elections has been welcomed by far-right parties from across Europe. The Brothers of Italy has relentlessly advocated for a free Europe, including sovereign countries, and promoted traditional values and essentialist conceptions of gender.
Certainly it won't be an easy task for Meloni to reassure the EU, other international partners and the moderate electorate, and at the same time maintain a strong connection with international populist groups and a more radical electorate. I don't think Meloni will ever find a way to mediate between these issues. That's why I believe her policies won't be too bold.
Among the defeated coalitions in Italy's national elections was the Democratic Party, growingly seen by a large number of Italians as the party of the establishment. Its leader, Enrico Letta, conceded defeat early on Monday, adding that his party would be the largest opposition force in the next parliament.
It is evident that mistakes were made. I will lead the next party until the next Congress, when a new leader will be determined.
According to the Italian constitution, newly elected members of the parliament must now meet within 20 days. The country's president, Sergio Mattarella, will begin consultations on who should be appointed as the new prime minister with the presidents of the Senate and Chamber of Deputies, the leaders of the main parties, and, at a later stage, with parliamentary groups. Max Civili, Rome.
The British pound takes a pounding yet again, only days after the country's finance minister announced the biggest tax-cutting package in decades, all funded by borrowing at a time of high inflation. They termed it a mini-budget, but it was a mega-shift in direction. The Chancellor confirmed the government would implement Prime Minister Liz Truss's leadership campaign pledges to reverse the national insurance rise, cancel the corporation tax rise, and a surprise new tax cut for the highest earners.
Take the additional rate of income tax. At 45%, it is currently higher than the headline top rate in G7 countries like the US and Italy. And it is even higher than social democracies like Norway. But I'm not going to cut the additional rate of tax today, Mr. Speaker. I'm going to abolish it altogether.
Ordinary Britons may not think about exchange rates on a daily basis, but a fall in the pound will affect their day-to-day.
Britain imports nearly half of its foodstuffs, and therefore the pound gets weaker, the cost of that, those basic foodstuffs goes up dramatically. And so anything which is coming in will be hitting inflation at a time when you don't want to have that. The only good news part of actually of this would be actually your exports are now better value. The trouble is if the global demand is shrinking, therefore the demand for those exports would also be shrinking.
There are also concerns about a long recession as winter looms with no end in sight to the energy crisis or the war in Ukraine. Online, calls for a general election are gaining traction. And in the Conservative Party itself, rumors about a no-confidence vote in the brand new prime minister.
Some experts say the UK's central bank, the Bank of England, could intervene to halt the pound sliding. Many others are saying the government's decision to borrow its way out of the current situation could end in tears. Saeed Burizap, London.
The crisis hit Lebanon is once again a scene of angry masses. The parliament is back to meet and debate a new budget. Yet protesters see the budget being discussed as elusive.
Instead of putting together a budget which encourages development in agriculture, industrial production and all fields in Lebanon, they want to impoverish the people and push them to die in the sea as they immigrate illegally. The government which relies on debt is being controlled by a mob, which is the Banks Association and the Central Bank. They should be held accountable for getting billions of dollars out of the country.
Banks reopened partially on Monday following a week-long closure in the wake of a wave of holdups. Depositors stormed at least 7 bank branches in the capital and abroad demanding their trapped savings.
We know these banks, you know, where we invested our money. But unfortunately, they stole the money between themselves and they plan. And every time they create a story.
One woman named Sally Hafez forced one branch to give her $13,000 of her savings, saying she needed it to pay for her sister's medical treatment. But she didn't take back her money on her own.
They left us no other choice. We encouraged Sally and we were with her when she held up the bank because it was a humanitarian situation. And we will be with all the people who urgently need their money. Our government is rotten and corrupt, and so is the judicial system.
The government has been procrastinating while time is running out. The governmental institutions, including schools, are almost out of service.
The entire governmental sector is paralyzed. The workers, the military personnel, the ministerial workers, the public teachers, they all have rights and they can barely do their job. There's no health care, no educational assistance. The budget plan the parliament is debating today is unfair.
Lebanon's economic downfall began in October 2019. The Lebanese pound has lost around 90% of its value against the U.S. dollar, but officials have failed to put in place necessary reforms. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Over 50 million Italians have been called to cast their ballot in what could be a pivotal election as Italy and a number of EU countries reel from repercussions of the conflict in Ukraine. The cost of energy has increased by 80% on average across the country compared to a year ago, while at the current rate, inflation is expected to reach 15% in 2023. With a growing number of Italians saying they've lost trust in politics, a high level of abstention from voting, much higher than the record low of 73% in the 2018 general elections, has been predicted.
I don't favor any of the candidates. I see little individual seriousness. As a matter of fact, I didn't want to vote at all. I only came to the polls out of my civic sense.
The electoral law must be changed. Those who deserve to rule are not rewarded. I have great distrust of the electoral system and of Italy's politics.
According to the current electoral law, which has already been reviewed twice by the Constitutional Court, citizens cannot pick their favorite candidates on the ballot. They can only vote for blocked lists. It's the parties themselves who will decide which candidates get the votes.
Last time a government was chosen by voters was 13 years ago when Berlusconi won the elections. All the elected governments that have followed have been overturned and replaced with executives of the establishment.
According to pollsters, a right-wing coalition is on course to win a comfortable majority of seats in both houses of the parliament, with the far-right Brothers of Italy party likely to win about 25% of the vote. The Democratic Party comes second with around 22% of preferences. Brothers of Italy party leader, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni, is predicted to become Italy's first ever female prime minister, heading a coalition that features anti-immigration populist Matteo Salvini and 85-year-old media tycoon Silvio Berlusconi. Meloni's flagship policies include defending traditional social values, anti-immigration programs, and the reduction of taxes. She has been supporting sanctions against Moscow so far, while Salvini and Berlusconi have recently said they should be reconsidered. Political analysts believe it could take weeks before a government is installed in the country. Some even say Italians will likely only see a new executive in November. However, if everything goes as expected, Giorgia Meloni stands as the next prime minister. Max Civili, Rome.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands. nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. The war between Russia and Ukraine is now in its ninth month, while people in four Ukrainian regions have started voting in referendums on joining Russia. Kiev claims to have expanded its territorial gains in the east. Moscow is now saying the West has become part of the war by supplying military aid and information to Kiev and is accusing the West of nuclear blackmail. In this edition of the Spotlight, we'll discuss the latest developments of the conflict and the West's role in the prolongation of the war. Joining us on the program, we have activist and political analyst and George Samueli, senior research fellow at Global Policy Institute from London Metropolitan University, joining us from Budapest.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Bosnic in Belgrade. Sir, the Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned the West that Moscow would use all available means to respond to threats against its territorial integrity. Putin also ordered Russia's first mobilization since World War II. What is your perspective on the recent developments with regards to the Ukraine conflict?
Well, I think that President Putin has made it very clear that he's not bluffing in this matter whatsoever, and that he intends to proceed with the integration of the ethnic Russian population of Ukraine into the Russian Federation, as that seems to be the only way to protect them from a war of genocide by the Ukrainian government.
George Samueli, Putin is accusing Western countries of engaging in nuclear blackmail and trying to destroy Russia. Can you explain what he means by that term, nuclear blackmail?
Well, I think that he means that the Western powers are essentially threatening Russia with nuclear war and thereby warning Russia away from continuing its ongoing military operations. But I think what he is really getting at here is that Russia will do whatever is necessary to protect its sovereignty and territorial integrity. And as Mr. Bosnich pointed out, following the referendums and the inevitable incorporation of these territories within the Russian Federation, that means henceforth any attacks on those territories will be regarded as attacks on the Russian Federation. And Russia has now said that we will respond with all means at our disposal on any attack on our territorial integrity.
John Bozich, speaking at the United Nations Security Council, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said countries supplying weapons to Ukraine and training its soldiers were parties to the conflict, adding that, quote, the intentional fomenting of this conflict by the collective West remained unpunished. The question is, will this support that Western countries are giving Ukraine result in this conflict spilling over into other regions and possibly turning into something bigger?
Well, that's always a possibility because the NATO powers seem to have lost their heads. They don't realize the seriousness of this situation. Ukraine cannot be seen without reference to Russia. Ukraine, the current territory known as Ukraine, was in fact the first settlement area of the Russian nation. There was a country called Rus, which was headquartered and its capital was Kiev. And so the fact that this conflict is taking place around Kiev and around the original historic heartland of the Russian people is indicative of how central and how important this is to the current Russian government in Moscow. The Western powers, for some reason, seem to think that a line drawn on a map has created in Ukraine some kind of a Western-oriented NATO military colony. They are so wrong that it can't be put into words.
George Samueli in Budapest, speaking at the United Nations General Assembly, U.S. President Joe Biden strongly denounced Russia's invasion of Ukraine, warning U.N. member states that, quote, if a nation can pursue imperial ambitions without consequences, then we put at risk everything this great institution stands for. It sounds like the kettle calling the pot black.
Yeah, it does indeed. And of course, what Biden said, and it's said repeated ad nauseum by the other NATO leaders, Emmanuel Macron, Liz Truss, Olaf Scholz, they will say the same thing, is that Russia, out of the blue, attacked Ukraine, unprovoked, unjustified aggression against the neighbor. This, of course, is completely untrue. Because, of course, this conflict has been going on for a considerable amount of time, at least for 8 years since essentially Ukraine launched a war against its own Russian-speaking population and failed to implement an agreement that was reached at Minsk, Minsk 1 agreement, Minsk 2 agreement, which was in fact incorporated within a UN Security Council resolution. So this was a UN Security Council resolution that supposedly the Western powers supported, but in fact did nothing whatever to coerce Kiev to attempt to implement. In fact, Kiev has admitted, or the former President Poroshenko admitted, that he was never had the slightest intention to implement Minsk. He was instead just buying time pretending to be interested in implementing an agreement, but actually using the time to become stronger and stronger. And NATO willingly cooperated with this, pouring in arms for 8 years into Ukraine with a view, obviously, to mounting basically a genocidal campaign against the Russian-speaking population, meaning they would just simply had the plan to drive them out altogether. So, but of course, that disappears from the view of the Western leaders, who just simply go back to the story. Oh, Russia just one day woke up and decided to attack Ukraine. Nothing at all happened beforehand. So, but what Biden says is the way Western media and Western politicians interpret what's going on. Completely untrue.
John Bosnich, the European Union is planning to impose new sanctions against Russia. The EU High Representative added Europe will continue to support Ukraine and provide it with military equipment as long as needed. Surely this will send ripple effects up and down the global market again. Tell us more about the ramifications of these measures and its repercussions for Europe, especially as winter approaches.
Well, I certainly wouldn't just call it ripple effects. I would call it a reverse tsunami. Yeah, exactly. Okay. What we've got here is every sanction that the Western powers, I prefer to call them just the American military colonies, in effect, every sanction they put on Russia is going to boomerang and hit them back twice as hard as it hits Russia. Russia has secured an export market for its primary export product, which is petroleum products, and the buyer is China. And China is not just a passive buyer. China is also a strong military power, which has an interest in maintaining the strength and integrity of Russia. So in every sanction that the Western military alliance puts on Russia, they are tightening the cooperation between Russia and China, and Russia and other countries such as Iran, which is attempting to pursue its own independent development. That's point one. Point number two. Under the current regime of sanctions, the energy crisis in Europe has reached such a stage that the European economies are going to collapse. When the European economies collapse, the people of Europe are going to look at their leaders and ask them, are you the leaders of our nations, or are you nothing more than American marionettes? If the public of Europe comes to the conclusion that their ruling class are all marionettes of a foreign power, we could see the collapse of the post-World War II U.S.-controlled European structures. And if that happens, this situation would not be a war, but it would be a tectonic shift of power in the entire world.
George Samuel, British Prime Minister Liz Truss has announced that in the following year, the UK will meet or exceed the amount of military aid spent on Ukraine in 2022. Is the UK in a position right now, in your opinion, to splash more money on military assistance to Ukraine rather than focus on its own economic troubles? Apart from that, interestingly, a British MP has said spending more on military aid to Ukraine will cut energy bills. How is that possible?
Well, of course, it isn't possible. And as you say, the UK does not have this kind of money. And the only way it can do so is if it starts printing money. But given that inflation in the UK is already on course to be around 20% by January, there is just simply no way that the UK can come up with this sort of money. But the issue, however, is a more serious one than that, because if the UK does indeed throw in this heavy military hardware into Ukraine, and this hardware is going to be used on Russian people, which is what's going to happen if Ukraine is going to continue with its war, then, of course, UK is explicitly a party to this war, and therefore the consequences could be quite serious for the UK. But almost certainly, Russia will respond by cutting off all energy exports to Europe altogether. I mean, it's not just going to be, well, it'll be 20% or 30% or whatever. It's going to be 0%. And when that happens, then I think the European economies will just come tumbling down. I mean, German economy is already, and that's the powerhouse of Europe, is already in a very precarious position. And once it's completely cut off, I think there's just going to be a complete collapse within Europe. And then we'll see what the political consequences will be, because this is an entirely unnecessary war in the first place, and it was entirely unnecessary for the European powers to get themselves into a war that had nothing to do with them and did not in any way threaten their security. So they've got themselves into this absolute catastrophe for no intelligible reason whatsoever, and I would indeed expect that there will be enormous political ramifications.
Mr. Bozich, let's put some focus on events on the ground. Ukraine claims to have reclaimed major swaths of territory with its counteroffensives, forcing Russian troops to retreat. I want to get your thoughts on that. Do you think it's due to the assistance that it's getting from the U.S. and its allies? And is this just what the U.S. and the NATO wants, this conflict to be a prolonged one, to see it dragged out for as long as possible in the hopes that it weakens Russia?
When the military historians look back on this conflict, they are going to praise the Russian generals and the Russian general staff for the brilliant way in which they pursued the battle. The recent gains, so-called gains, by the Ukrainian army, especially in the northeastern region around Kharkov, have been taken at the expense of several hundred Russian soldiers and the loss of more than 4,700 Ukrainian soldiers. We're talking a death count up to 20 times higher on the Ukrainian side. And what they've achieved is they've inherited an area of empty ground with no resources and nothing of any value. What has happened here is Russia has arranged a strategic withdrawal, which drew in a Ukrainian army, their best reserves, put them on an open plain, and allowed them to be destroyed from the air. Now, this is what Russia could have done to the city of Kiev at the beginning of the war and chose not to do in the interests of finding a negotiated solution. Now that Kiev has made it clear, and the NATO colonies, NATO military colonies in the EU, have backed it up, it looks like time for real war. Real war means that Russia is going to withdraw its strategic reserves from other areas and put them into the battle. Now, Russia is a country of 145 million people. It can easily put another 300,000 men in the field, and these are not green recruits. These are people who have already gone through military training and have served in the Russian military. Ukraine has no such recruits available. It will be a walkover if it becomes a full-scale war. And if it's a walkover, this is not just the defeat of Ukraine, but the defeat of NATO. And we can see the very, very high possibility that NATO itself will fracture and will lose member countries, starting with Romania and Hungary.
George Samuel, your referendums on joining Russia are due to take place from today until Tuesday in several largely Russian-held regions in the east and in the south of Ukraine, which, as a matter of fact, comprise around 15% of the country's territory. Ukraine and its allies have said that such votes would be illegal. The UN chief also has expressed concerns over the referendums. What is your take on the issue of these referendums being held?
Well, we can be pretty sure that the referendum will be overwhelmingly in favor of joining the Russian Federation. We also know that the constitutional process of incorporating these territories within the Russian Federation will be accomplished very quickly If you remember how it was with Crimea in 2014, it was done very quickly. So the State Duma will pass the appropriate legislation, and then President Putin will sign it, and these territories will be a part of Russia. And of course, it now means that Ukraine will be targeting, if it continues the war, and it says it intends to continue the war, the NATO powers, all of them have said, yeah, nothing changes. We don't care about any referendum. We're going to continue doing everything that we've been doing. Well, that means that they are ready to escalate to a full-scale war with Russia. And of course, Russia, you know, can easily insert this 300,000 reserves and more. It's a big country. And the casualties that Russia has sustained so far are vastly dwarfed by the casualties sustained by Ukraine, which is, you know, about a third, you know, maybe even about a quarter of Russia's size. So as Russia escalates, Ukraine has no means of escalating because it's already sustained casualties. Now, the Russians have estimated that Ukrainians have lost about 60,000 killed in action. That may be true or may not be true. We don't know for sure, but most estimates are in that ballpark. So Ukraine doesn't have any additional manpower that it can draw upon other than if NATO were to get directly involved themselves. Well, you know, this is the time for, you know, NATO to put up or shut up. I mean, having said all this time, well, we're not directly involved in this war. We're not party to it. Well, you know, Kyiv is going to turn to them and say, okay, are you ready to get directly involved? I suspect that they're not, in which case they will have no choice but to tell Kyiv it's time to knock it up. Now, it's possible that they're so stupid and they're so crazy that they will get involved directly. Unfortunately, for NATO, they're not really in any position in that part of Europe to wage any kind of a war against Russia. It's a hell of a big undertaking for them to get kind of manpower into Ukraine.
John Bosnich, final question to you. In retrospect, could the U.S. and NATO, could have acted differently to de-escalate the situation altogether? Russia put forth its request, Ukraine can't join NATO, and no more eastward expansion of the military alliance. What do you think?
Well, in fact, they can't do that because the sole purpose of NATO is to drive to the east, or as Hitler and the Kaisers before him called it, Drang nach Osten. It's a perpetual desire of the Central European powers grouped around the former Austro-Hungarian Empire and Imperial Germany. This is the fundamental reason for NATO. And when I look at the data here, it's not that NATO has become involved in this war. NATO is this war. Zelensky is NATO's puppet. Ukraine is a victim of NATO's foreign policy. And when I look at the list of what charges can be laid against the NATO leadership, I don't even know where one would start. Torture, ethnic cleansing, genocide, Nazi revanchism, the creation and violation of media rights, and the fundamental violation of the human rights of not only the ethnic Russian citizens of Ukraine, but the ethnic Ukrainian citizens of Ukraine who've been tricked and cheated into a war that should have never taken place. Where the prosecution will begin, I don't know. But where it will end, I do know. In Kyiv.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, journalists, activists, and political analyst John Bosnich, joining us from Belgrade, and also senior research fellow at Global Policy Institute, Mr. George Samueli, joining us from Budapest. Thank you for contributing to the show. It's good night for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Puerto Rico is suffering from the consequences of another major hurricane. Hurricane Fiona brings the experiences of the past with itself. Weak infrastructure, discrimination, and inequality in Puerto Rico. Stay tuned for the first part, please. In this regard, the website of Axios wrote, Puerto Ricans are scrambling to figure out how or whether to rebuild after yet another major disaster. There are some issues, including a state of play. About 33% of homes and businesses were still without power recently, more than a week after Hurricane Fiona hit, according to Luma Energy, the island's grid operator. Thousands still don't have running water. Some roads remain blocked by flooding and rock slides, leaving several communities in the south isolated, without access to supplies. Driving the news, while Fiona, a Category 1 hurricane when it made landfall, was considerably weaker than 2017's hurricanes Maria and Irma, both Category 5 storms, its devastation is expected to compound the already strained recovery efforts from the past disasters. Estimates put the damages of Hurricane Maria at $100 billion. About $28 billion in federal funds had been earmarked for recovery projects at the beginning of August. Many homes destroyed by Maria and the island's power grid were still being rebuilt when Fiona hit. Plus, the pandemic hit Puerto Rico's economy especially hard. More than 40% of the island's population lived below the poverty line last year, according to census data. For small business owners, the cascade of disasters on top of the island's long-standing bankruptcy issues has made even the thought of rebuilding again hard to bear. This is the fifth time everything floods, the fifth time I lose it. Carmelo Varquez Rivera, who owns a TV and electronics repair shop, told Noticias Telemundo after Fiona hit, adding, I've started back up before, but this time I just don't have the strength. The big picture. A U.S. Congress-established financial oversight board nicknamed La Junta remains mostly in charge of the island's budget. La Junta has been criticized by some lawmakers who argue the board's austerity measures after Hurricane Maria made recovery harder. La Junta agreed to release up to $250,000 to each of Puerto Rico's 78 municipalities for Fiona's recovery. President Biden also approved a major disaster declaration for the island and ordered federal aid to assist with recovery efforts. But many worry the money and declaration won't be enough, especially for an island with a history of corruption, delays in aid distribution, and budgetary mismanagement. Others have taken authorities to task for not enacting more programs that could make the island more resilient. There should have been more investments in weather-resistant designs of roads and the grid line. Martha Quinones, professor at the Universidad de Puerto Rico, told El Nuevo Día. Puerto Rican authorities in 2019 set a goal of transitioning to renewable power by 2050, which would help more people weather the storms by having a grid that doesn't get as easily knocked down by winds and rain. But as of February, about 3% of the island's electricity comes from renewables, mostly pushed by NGOs working with solar power. There is also a concern that the island will continue to experience the brain drain that worsened after Hurricanes Maria and Irma. The island saw an 11.8% drop in its population between 2010 and 2020, according to census data. Part of that is due to the island's struggling economy made worse by crisis after crisis. Many people who have remained on the island have been pushed out of their homes by land developers and cryptocurrency investors who have bought out apartment buildings and other properties, making rents soar and prompting more Puerto Ricans to leave for the mainland U.S. The bottom line, the island was still years away from fully recovering from Maria and Irma when Fiona hit. Those recovery efforts are expected to take longer now, leaving many Puerto Ricans fearing for when the next disaster may strike. Politico also writes, "What up, recast family? President Joe Biden declares the pandemic is over and questions arise over weather. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis had the budget authority to fly migrants to Martha's Vineyard. Plus, Adnan Said, whose case inspired the Miget podcast serial, is freed from prison. First, though, we focus on the latest unfolding in Puerto Rico. The latest collapse of Puerto Rico's power grid after it was thrashed by Hurricane Fiona over the weekend was a foreseeable crisis that activists, including Puerto Rican Bonnie, have been working to prevent a crisis deeply rooted in the island's status as a U.S. territory. Turn back the calendar to 5 years ago today. Hurricane Maria, coming less than 2 weeks after Hurricane Irma, was the strongest hurricane to hit the island in nearly a century. The website of Politico wrote, Maria, a category 4 storm that caused an estimated 2,975 deaths, decimated Puerto Rico's power, water, healthcare systems. The island has never truly recovered from that blow. In those intervening years, those living on the island have had to endure multiple crises, including earthquakes that further destabilized the power grid, not to mention the COVID-19 pandemic. With Fiona, the island suffered yet another total blackout when the then Category 1 storm knocked out power to 1.5 million customers, dumped some 32 inches of rain on some parts of the island, and triggered catastrophic flooding and widespread loss of water service.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.